Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. Thank you again for getting us connected to the show, and welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. You know, we're talking about keeping your phone handy. I actually spoke with someone today on campus that said they're so sick of answering the phone, they're about ready to throw it away. You know, that could be. That actually could be. There's a nice book out. I don't know the exact title, but I think I'm going to buy it and read it. It talks about the information overload and how people, we just can't comprehend all of this now, and how we've talked on the radio show about how Google's kind of making us a skimmer in the internet. We just go from this to that, and we don't really spend a lot of time on it and a lot of concentration. And what it's doing, it's frying people's brains. And they've actually shown now through studies that if you put that doggone thing down and shut that computer off, your memory and your sensibilities come back. Anyway, join the world of the not-so-sensible in the Blog Talk Radio Network. Tonight we're going to deal with a special subject I think you'll enjoy. We're going to have the former administrator of the Transportation Security Agency, TSA. You know, those friendly folks at the airport that sometimes may be interpreted as being a little too friendly. We're going to have him talk about that. And he's got some really insightful comments about what's going on. It's more than an hour show, so I don't want to spend a lot of time warming up tonight for that. And he takes a little time getting started, but I think you'll find it interesting. And we're taking it off of the booktv.org, so you can go and hear the rest of it, his presentation, his interview there. I'm your host, Keith Haley. Thank Johnny Cash for taking us on that long trip. Every now and then, I think I'd like to memorize the words of that song. I've actually never done it. If I do, I promise to sing it on the air. Yeah, that chance. Okay, Emily and Mike, thank you very much for joining us. Lucy's not here again tonight. And guess what? For the first time in the history of the radio show, Lucy gave me permission, I am doing the Bond joke. And it's a good one, so I won't take too long, but I think I know how to do them. What we try to do in the show is discuss news and issues and events and developments in this always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. Our show is dedicated to the CJ professionals that work for us tirelessly, not only in the United States, but but around the world. We try to look inside criminal justice practice and take a real close-up look at the professionals, what they're doing, the work. Tonight's interview will be something like that, a guy that really knows the TSA business, and you don't get to hear them talk much, actually, unless you're listening to C-SPAN and testimony and that type of thing before Congress, but we'll do that. Don't forget that you can have your own show on Blog Talk Radio. Don't forget that at all. I don't know how many shows are on right now while we're doing ours, but there's probably, I saw this afternoon when I went on the net, there was 5 shows going on at the same time, or probably 35 or more than that tonight, but literally in minutes, and they say that on the website, you can have your own radio show. Any person, interest group, or organization can be broadcasting live via the internet to an unlimited number of listeners worldwide, and it doesn't cost you one penny. Who would have believed it just 10 years ago? The shows are archived also. All of our shows are archived on podcastdirectory.com, and you can pick out shows and go back, and sometimes folks around the country use them for a class in criminal justice or some related type of subject. So get your own show if you have time to do it. I told you tonight what we're going to be listening to, and I think you're really going to enjoy Chip Hawley. He was the former administrator of the Transportation Security Agency. I think he was the head of that for about 4 years. He left in 2009, and he's got some good insights about that show. If you want to call in during the news segment of the show, you can actually do that, 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983. And we can hold, how many calls now, Mike? 50. We can hold 50 calls. We don't even get one. So that's good. We got a lot of news to cover tonight. So anyway, right, here's the blonde joke, ladies and gentlemen. If you please allow me for the first time to do the blonde joke. And this one has to do with a highway patrol officer outdoing his job. It does say it's a patrolman, so it's a he. A highway patrolman pulled alongside a speeding car on the freeway. Glancing at the car, he was astounded to see that the blonde driver behind the wheel was knitting. Realizing that she was oblivious to his flashing lights and the siren, the trooper cranked down his window, turned on his bullhorn, and yelled, "Pull over." "No," the blonde yelled back. "It's a scarf." It's a scarf. What do you think of that? It's a scarf, not a pullover. All right. Thank you very much. That's a good one. Lucy actually found that one for us. that's a funny one. It's a pullover. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, we know that firearms remain a serious business, although we have right to carry laws all over the place, and 48 states have those, so we want to make sure that the criminals get the message that they can turn their guns in. So we're going to allow the Ohio Gun Coalition to broadcast their audio one more time as a public service announcement.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
It certainly is a deadly idea. And along with serious things like that, we are trying to save the planet. I was listening to an NPR story today. I won't elaborate, but it was very funny. They were looking at all these green energy programs and all that business. And they had some massively funded study they were talking about, which I'm sure you and I paid for with our tax money. And they couldn't actually tell whether this new green energy actually was saving the planet any better than using the energy that we're currently using now, petroleum products, et cetera. So anyway, the green industry moves on. I still think if we took all the prisoners in the United States that are in prison and put them on treadmills, we could probably generate a lot of energy, and we'd keep them busy and keep them slim. So anyway, but our green tip for tonight is this. Most everybody brushes their teeth. We haven't found that yet as a green tip to stop doing that. But if you want to be even greener when it comes to dental hygiene, choose a toothpaste based on vegetable products rather than the more common chemically manufactured versions. You'll need less to use in the application also. I never shop for vegetable-based toothpaste. I'll have to do that. Ew, it's not green, is it? I hope not. Mike, have you ever done that? No, he hasn't. I can't find anyone on the set tonight that's actually used a vegetable-based toothpaste. Kind of gets me. All right, let's take a look at some criminal justice news tonight. Some really interesting things going on. And if I can get it up here, where did it go? There it is. I'll get to it a little bit later, but some things developing in the Zimmerman-Trayvon Martin case in Florida. But this is one that everybody's been talking about on the radio today, so why can't I talk about it? This high school in Utah was being fined $15,000 by the federal government. Do you know why? They didn't lock up their vending machines during the lunch hour. I'm not kidding you. Federal law, I'm going to try to keep a straight face. Federal law requires the school to turn off its soda machines during the lunch period, which is 47 minutes during the day. The high school did turn off the machines in the lunchroom. However, they didn't realize that there was another machine in the school bookstore that wasn't being turned off. And when the food police realized it, the school was hit with a 75 cents fine per student for the duration of the offense. Now the school is going to have to cut money to find arts to the fine arts program to make up the cost in order to pay the fine. Now, what's odd about this, you can't get your soft drink, but guess what you can get? You can buy sugar-loaded sports drinks and even Snickers bars because why? You guessed it, they contain nuts. So nuts are part of the natural foods that you should be eating. So Snickers must be good for you. I love Snickers. Who doesn't? Students can buy soda earlier in the day before the machines get turned off, and then they drink it during lunch. So they can actually bring a soda that they bought earlier to the lunch, but they can't use the machines. And this poor school is having to pay a $15,000 fine. The principal says this isn't right. He said the kids will leave campus. He said, what are you going to do? Close Walmart and Quick Trip for four, it must be a, I don't know what a Quick Trip is, must be a convenience store or something, for 47 minutes a day while we're having lunch period? Don't give them any ideas. Anyway, really weird. Related to that, if you plan to, it's another study, which I'm sure some federal money went for. If you plan to chow down tonight at a big chain restaurant, there's a better than 9 in 10 chance that your entree will fail to meet federal nutrition recommendations for both adults and kids. This is a provocative new study. It says a whopping 96% of main entries sold at U.S. chain eateries exceed daily limits for calories, sodium, fat, and saturated fat recommended by the Department of Agriculture of the United States. This is an 18-month study conducted by the RAND Corporation and funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and I'll bet you Robert Wood probably got himself some federal money to actually do that. They looked at, stop Mike, don't laugh. They looked at 30,923 menu items from 245 restaurant brands across the United States. And they found out these kinds of things, that 90% of these exceeded the nutrition standards set. Who sets those? Are the United States congressmen? I think we ought to make them weigh in every day and put them on a diet, because I've seen some that look a little chub, wouldn't you think? But they're recommending that no meal exceed 674 calories. I thought it was 671. Or was it 679? Or was it whatever? Okay. You've heard about my diet book. Just go to archive.org. You can buy it on Amazon, but go to archive.org and look at the three-bowl diet, the key to weight control forever, and it will show you that you can eat whatever you want. You fill up the bowl three times a day, and that's it. Move more, eat less. What else can we learn? But we'll continue to spend millions on this kind of stuff. Okay, let's look at the Zimmerman case in Florida. Terrible that Trayvon Martin was shot and killed, of course, but it was also terrible that George Zimmerman was being beat up. And we now know he had a bloody face and nose. We now know there are two witness accounts that were there to back up Zimmerman's version of what happened when they describe a man on his back with another person wearing a hoodie straddling him and throwing punches at him. And Trayvon Martin's father told an investigator after listening to the 9/11 tapes that captured a man's voice frantically calling for help, that it was not his son that was calling for help, so it was Zimmerman. Zimmerman was 26 years old. Trayvon Martin was 17 years old. Zimmerman, they mentioned, is multiracial Hispanic, and Zimmerman was a 6-foot-tall African-American weighing 160 pounds. Two police officers reported that when they arrived at the scene, Zimmerman seemed to have a broken nose and bloodied face. One wrote that his facial area was bloodied and the back of his clothing was soiled with wet grass. So these facts just keep kind of sneaking out about this case. The broken nose was kept from us here for a while. And the idea of two, I'd never heard that there were two witnesses to this thing. They're probably doing that to protect them. And here's the final thing. Martin's autopsy report also revealed that there was a 1/4 inch by 1/2 inch abrasion on the left forefinger of Martin, another indication of a possible struggle. The teen lived in Miami, even Sanford, while serving suspension for a bag of marijuana being discovered in his possession. And the autopsy actually showed that Martin was shot from a distance of 1 inch to 18 inches away. So it wasn't like he was running down the street. Zimmerman was running down the street looking for Martin. It sounds like Martin was on top of me, or at least very close. So we'll have to see what happens in that particular case. I'm not going to do the one about prison rape. President Obama and the Justice Department are taking good moves about preventing prison rape. A lot of people say you can't do anything about it. We finally got the PREA Act here a number of years back, and we're doing something about it. Imagine one of your relatives going to prison for a traffic homicide, and then they get in prison, and about 1 out of 10 of them get raped, and it's shocking and disturbing, more than that, about how many of these cases involve prison staff members themselves as the perpetrator in these particular crimes. So they did a big survey about this, but I'm not going to talk much about the case because it takes a long time to do it. But we ought to be doing something about that. I have a discussion thread about that in one of my online classes, and many people and the students say, you know, well, there's nothing. What are you going to do about it? And I'm saying there is something you can do about it. First of all, you need to fire the people that get involved in it, the staff members, and then prosecute them. It's a felony crime to be participating in something like that in virtually, I think, most states. But you never hear about that going on, and prosecutors won't take the cases. So anyway, we'll have to see what happens with that. Okay, Homeland Security, let's hold off on that one also. Got one more here we might take a look at. That's a long one too, about New York City cops frisk 200,000 people in the first 3 months of the year. That's a 10% increase over what they did last year. But a frisk means you have to have reasonable suspicion that they're involved in some type of either they're involved in a crime or they're carrying a weapon. So it's not just walking up to everybody and patting them down. Reasonable suspicion is about 3 steps up on the proof continuum from no proof to hunch to suspicion to reasonable suspicion. But it's been a very good and very good case. And that was an Ohio case that actually permitted that Supreme Court case back in the 1960s. Okay, let's switch over here and go to the Transportation Security former administrator. And this is Kip Hawley. And his book is called Permanent Emergency, The Truth About the TSA. And the rest of the subtitle, and the fight for the future of American security. He's got some ideas here about using brains instead of just policy. And many of these TSA people do exactly what the policy book says. He's saying maybe we could switch and use their brains a little bit, and it would be less intrusive, et cetera. So here we go with that. Give me a little minute, a minute here to set it up, and I think you'll enjoy this one.
Former administrator of the Transportation Security Agency presents his thoughts on how to reimagine the United States security efforts. This is a little over an hour.
Sure. Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. Let me welcome you to George Washington University for the Homeland Security Policy Institute. Let me also welcome the viewers on C-SPAN. I think we have we're in for a real treat today. To hear from, and I, for complete transparency, need to say is a good friend of mine, someone I think who probably stepped into the breach and took on, if not the hardest, certainly one of the most difficult jobs inside the United States government, former administrator of the Transportation Security Administration, TSA. But someone who came to this to the issue after 9/11, to the issue after 9/11, with a lot of experience from a FAA perspective, from the Department of Transportation's perspective, but also from the private sector, to be able to look at supply chain and risk and all the sorts of things that we talk about today when we talk about aviation security, but I'm not sure we always execute. Our verbs are not always at the same level of our nouns. But here to share some of his insights, not only on his time with TSA, but also to give a sense and a bit of a landscape in terms of where we are, where we hope to be, and what major gaps and shortfalls from a vulnerability perspective, but also from a process perspective, perhaps we can enhance our country's capability. I mean, all things said and done, this is one of the toughest jobs inside the U.S. government. And I used to say most people's impression of the government was the DMV or IRS. Rarely does that give a great conjure up a great image in people's minds, and TSA is the next agency that has most contact in a day-to-day environment for the U.S. government. But they've got an important mission. I can tell you, shortly after 9/11, there were steps that absolutely needed to be taken and needed to be taken quickly. That said, we've got to continue to ask the hard questions, make sure we're doing things as well as we can. And Kip, you're here to make us all smarter on these issues. So if you haven't bought it yet, Permanent Emergency, buy it. Well worth the read. And I'm doing other interviews, and every call-in question has to do with your book. So congratulations on finishing that. No easy feat. And thank you for joining us today. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank, for the introduction. Thank you for hosting this. It means a great deal to me. Frank is one of the consistently sane voices in an otherwise discombobulated world. And it's an honor to be here under the auspices of the George Washington Homeland Security Policy Institute. And I hope we can make this interactive. Because I certainly have learned a lot in the last couple of days from some of the media questions on this. And probably the biggest learning is that if you just look in today's news and you see about the arrests in Los Angeles and four-year-old pat-downs and congressional pat-downs, and we live in a world where TSA is a permanent emergency. And it kind of closes the loop on the name of my book, which is Permanent Emergency. And come to find out, this is, today is a perfect example of how we have urgent, pressing, serious news very frequently about TSA, and therefore, we never actually get out of the emergency mode. And now 10 years after 9/11, it is beyond time where we need to get out of that permanent emergency mode and find some ways to make good security, excellent security, world-class security, something that is sustainable and supported by the American public. And I guess that's the place I would start off that got me going on the book was on January 20th, 2009, it struck noon, and I was outside in the cold day without a job, and I was like, okay, what next? And I realized that I was walking off with a lot of learnings that I'd had from being involved in situations that are unique. And there was no real way to download that to the public or really anyone else. And I just thought the government, the taxpayers have paid for all this experience. You ought to share it. And so that really started me thinking. And what we did is took the time period that I was around TSA, both beginning of 2001 and going up to 2009, and found the intelligence substrata of what was running through on the classified world. And I did a timeline looking at the various plots that I was involved with during that time, and then another timeline of what was going on in the public. And it was a complete, if you looked at one timeline, it was very familiar because we've all seen it. But then, if you look at the bottom timeline, it was notable for the intensity of the plots. And I thought, if the public knew both the up and the down of this timeline, it would be a far more informed discussion of TSA and counterterrorism in general. So that's what the book is. Nathan Means is the co-author. And I knew that Nathan is a very fine writer, and that's how I got to know him, and we worked together. And it was only upon discovering some time later when I was describing this to a colleague, well, have you Googled him? And I went, yeah, a little bit. And turns out that young Nathan is a rock star and actually is part of a cult band from the 90s called Trans Am and tours the world with his band, but they don't make enough money to be able to do their music. So he writes books as kind of a sideline. And what it did for the book was I'd write these incredibly exciting, dramatic, compelling pieces, and he would return them with a shrug, like, you know, it's boring. And so that really, I think, has turned the book into something, into a bunch of stories that are themselves interesting, but bring forth information that has not been seen before in the public. And a couple of things about the book: it got massive pickup with the Wall Street Journal that I was frankly not expecting. I had heard that they were going to do a review of the book, but it got a lot more attention and has focused on my handy top five things to quote unquote fix TSA, and I'd be happy to get into those to the extent that you want, particularly those with TSA badges hidden somewhere. but really, that is interesting and notable. But the larger issue of trust and accountability, and how do we deal fundamentally with these issues going forward, I think is worth thinking about. And at the end of the day, when the spy stories are done with permanent emergency, I hope that what comes from that is a discussion of what we want as an American public with our security agencies and what trade-offs we want to make. So we went through a story about the beginning of TSA and this and that and the other thing. And the accountability part, I just focus on that before opening it up for conversation, is that at the beginning of TSA, you have 450 airports that are trying to be started up with an entirely new workforce, everything brand new. So what is it that you're thinking about at the top of your head? It's, we got to make this all more or less look the same and see that they're doing the same thing at each place. And we hire people, train them, et cetera. high premium on getting it to be consistent. But what happens when you roll ahead 3 or 4 years and the rules are so dense that the net effect is that you've asked your officers who you hired, who came to the agency to protect the country after 9/11, you're saying, welcome aboard, don't think. Here is what you do, and if you go outside of this list, you're disciplined. So it was not anybody's intention to make it that way, and it wasn't anybody's intention to make the pay system where there were not pay raises, were not job opportunity promotions. And it had the effect of really ossifying our security system. Now you say, well, why could that possibly, how could it stay that way? Well, one of the things that that system does is protect everybody, because if I go to work and I follow that standard operating procedure, no matter what happens, at the end of the day, I go home and I'm protected. And as long as I stay within the lines of my standard operating procedure, I will come back and I'll retire in 30 years. And what I realized early on from Secretary Chertoff was that it doesn't matter what the process is. You are personally accountable for whatever the result is. And there is no going to Congress and saying, you know, we feel terrible about the plane blowing up, but we followed standard procedure. It's just that there's no place to hide. And what this book explains is a bunch of stories about frontline officers who took on that engagement and that accountability, and clearly I am in favor of that. I also point out that the flip side of that is that when you allow people to think, they make mistakes. And if you're going to say, have the big soundbite, we are going to turn the brains on of our officers and et cetera, if you take that soundbite, you've got to also take the question when a series of mistakes happens at checkpoints because officers have discretion. It is a very difficult question, and I clearly have one opinion on it, but it drives to the very core of what your security operation is. And I think that is a central issue that we need to decide as an American public on our security. What is the risk we are willing to absorb? Is it that Abu Mutallah gets on the plane and singes his private parts and maybe hurts a couple of people or kills a couple of people? Is it worth doing an aggressive pat-down to prevent that occurring? Or other alternatives. So when it all comes down to it, we use the word risk management, and it's a dime a dozen to say risk management. But when you really get deep into it, I think there's some fundamental issues that are easily accessible, don't involve classified information, that I think we all ought to discuss. So with that, I thank you for coming and welcome your conversation.
Thank you, Kip. And I'll start with a couple of questions, but then want to open it up to the audience, since I think your premise and your most central point is that for us to be able to succeed, it needs to be part of the community, and the general public has to assume some ownership. Obviously, given the fact that we have been successful in many of our counterterrorism initiatives, as well as preventing others from going on to a plane, people kind of are lulled, potentially. I am concerned that we're being lulled into a sense of complacency, while the flip side is we don't want to constantly be going ups and downs. We're in a hospital, so you don't want the EKG going like that. You certainly don't want it flatline. Point being, what kinds of steps can we actually take to try to get to win over the general public, A? B, you were at the helm of TSA. What could you have done differently if you were to take that position in a Romney or an Obama II administration, whatever it may be? But say to the future administration, what would you have done differently? And then thirdly, along those lines, what surprised you most coming into the department that side. And you know, I'm the other adjective you use, which I think is spot on, is agile. I mean, we've got to remember we're dealing with a thinking predator that are going to base their actions on our actions. And if you advertise exactly how you're going to defend yourself, you're displacing risk. You're not removing it, and you're not even managing it. You're, in essence, displacing it. So first question, how do we get the popular, how do we get the general public on board? What can be taken? What practical and pragmatic steps? Secondly, given your time at TSA, easy to identify some of the challenges.
Yeah.
Very difficult to be in the position where you have to have those conversations with the general public. And thirdly, what would you be advising the next administrator at TSA to do?
Well, I'll start with the third one, which is easy. And that is, I hope the next administrator of TSA is just a person named John Pistol who has a 10-year term. And we have the stability of a leader who understands risk management, understands the security needs, understands intelligence operations, and is the highest integrity. So I think that would be a good place to start. I go back to how do we get the public back on board? How do we win back the public? I look at Israel, and everybody comes back from Israel and wants to talk about profiling or wants to talk about the interview they get or wants to talk about Israeli security. But to me, the fundamental premise of Israeli security is that the Israeli people and the security services are totally together. And that is power way beyond what you can buy with scanning equipment or detect with pat-downs. And that is a core learning that I had in understanding about how Israel does its security. And I think that for the United States, this is a security issue that the American public feels so divided from its security. And what I said in the Wall Street Journal was I came up with five things that I believe could be implemented within more or less a month that would get the conversation going with the public. And I truly believe that the prohibited items list was necessary. It was necessary for the American public. It was good for security. 2001, 2002, 2003, somewhere along the line, it's outlived its usefulness in everything, in my opinion, other than bombs, guns, and toxins, things that can take down a plane or very quickly kill a lot of people. The amount of time and energy we spend fishing through bags, pulling out prohibited items, is a waste. And I think it drives the officers to focus on things that really are not a security risk to the aircraft. You certainly could kill somebody with your bare hands or a knife, but that's not what I believe TSA is there to do. So the prohibited items, I would say, yep, let knives on board, get rid of that. Allow your officers to focus on explosives, allows them to focus on the people, the behavior. So I think they did that. I've talked about the liquids, which is the liquid scanner, the ATX machines that are in airports today, if loaded with software that exists today, can detect threat liquids and does unfortunately produce false positives, which will slow the lane down. But my second recommendation is to make that choice open to the public. If you want to bring your liquids on and take it out of your bag, put it in a gray bin, do it. And go through this line, maybe it takes longer. If you don't, if you want to get through really fast, do your baggie and away we go. But I think having more choices out there for the public to make is also a way to increase the credibility. And of course, what you say is, well, Kip, that's going to really clog things up. And what I say is, you didn't read suggestion number one, which is get rid of that prohibited items list. You fix that, and then suddenly those lanes become a lot quicker, even with the liquids. The third is the TSOs, and really just hitting the pedal to the metal with what used to be called the ENGAGE program, which has to do with training them on explosives, on terrorist tradecraft and getting them to relate to the public before them, pay for performance, that whole realm of things. Baggage fees. This is sounds like it's a throwaway because, well, what cost is it to me to tell airlines not to make as much money? But the airlines today pay fees to TSA, and I would gladly say, I'll bet you, that if you told the airlines you no longer have to pay this fee or any fees for that matter to TSA, just do not encourage passengers to bring so much carry-on through the checkpoint, you'd save so much money at TSA. You'd get a better security result because the officers would have clearer bags, and the public would like that. So I think getting rid of those baggage fees is a security issue. It is clogging the checkpoints, making it more difficult for the officers. The fourth thing I had, the fifth thing, which is random, and we have that in every security regime, whether it's your bank security system or anything else. But random allows you to choose from a much broader spectrum of security measures, and as John Fissell says, it's not one size fits all, but you have a vast number of security possibilities that you randomize. And given that TSA now has the ability to look at reservations up to 72 hours in advance, it gives them time to prepare a specific security answer for each specific person. You can have that ahead of time, encrypt it in the boarding pass, and work in the random as well. So that would be get the public back on your side. The biggest mistake, or there was sort of a question there about that, right? Or
well, you would have done differently.
Yeah.
I might note it is easier to start things and harder to get rid of them when they're in place. So
yes.
That's part of the systematic.
Yes. I think I was then, and those who are at TSA will find this shocking. I think I was too tentative, and I should have just gone for it with the get rid of all prohibited items. I started off with scissors and got my head handed to me. And went back for more for lighters. We had to get an act of Congress passed. At that point, I lost my enthusiasm for going one by one to the prohibited items. And I should have just started that off. And I think with Secretary Chertoff, who has guts and really truly believes in risk-based security, it's possible he may have gone ahead with that. But you have such a short time. I was there 3.5 years, which is longer than anybody else. But you really can't make these changes and stick them through in that period of time, which is why I say for Administrator Pistol, I hope he is there. And I'm sorry, John, to say this to you, but I actually have to say it to him. But that there's a 10-year term, and that allows people to get comfortable. This person's going to be here a while and get on board. And I'm not going to serve in any future administration in any capacity. You can all relax. Thank you.
But, I mean, I actually like the 10-year term. It's sort of like FBI.
Yeah, it's like filled
it out to be a genuine law enforcement kind of agency. The problem is you've got rule books that are up to here. Because, I mean, you look at the military, what they learned the hard way, and unfortunately it took men and women in dying to learn that you need to push decisions down to the front lines. I mean, it's about commander's intent. You define the objectives. Ultimately, it's the men and women who are closest to the action who get things done. We're nowhere near that concept in this space. Do you ever see that?
Yes. I think we were darn close to that with this Engage program that we had, where we took every officer and trained them in for 2 full days on exactly this. To prepare them, where we ran into implementation trouble was once it got out to the field and the officers started to think, "Wow, I get to make these decisions. I hope I don't make a wrong one." And then the first level of management, the second level of management, the third level, on up the chain was like, "What? You're going to let them make that call, and I'm going to be accountable for that result?" And that's a very hard thing. So that's a 10-year project, and we got about 2 years into it, and I don't know what the status of it is today. I talk to officers when I travel, and I get varying during answers.
Things will go awry. So questions, and please identify yourself. And do we have a mic coming? Or to speak loudly.
The question I would have to ask, it was back to your credibility question with the public, and that is the use of intelligence, the very tactical intelligence. You're involved with the TSA. When you were there, obviously not specific instances, but when you were there, what was the judgment in terms of trying to determine at what point in time do you start to tell the public, we've got something here, this is a threat, we need to worry about it? Because, just, and forgive me for 1 second, because one of the things that seems to be happening is that we will make these statements, they'll drop away, and people will say, well, haven't we heard this before, and then nothing happens.
Right. Right. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, was to give the backdrop to that. And I'll give you one specific answer. And this one I was not timid on.
Yeah.
There was in 2007 a disturbing trend of Al-Qaeda training with remote control toy vehicles as ways to bring bombs on planes. And it was coming from very, very, very good sources. And upsetting to me was the fact that it was corroborated with different things. So it was not just that there was one training camp. It was there was a training camp, then you'd see something over here with this. And I'm looking to see if Charlie Allen here is about to jump me. But fortunately, some guys in Goose Creek, South Carolina, were driving, and they had a video with a remote control toy vehicle. So we seized on that, and we went back to the NCGC, National Counterterrorism Center, and asked if we could get a terror line report, which is the term of art meaning something that used to be classified that you can get something unclassified. And then we put out an announcement, hello, we are looking at remote control toy vehicles. And you may notice that if you bring one, we're not going to prohibit it, but we are going to take it apart and look at it very carefully. Have a nice day. And so we did not change any regulations. We did not, you know, we just put that out there. And I think that is a great example of what TSA does today in terms of being connected to the intelligence community and the intelligence community being willing to work backwards and say, okay, you can actually use that, because normally you know what the odds of, yeah, we want to take your intel, you just and make it a public statement, not going to happen, but it does happen. And I've seen Administrator Pistol do the same thing, and I think it's highly effective. Low cost, no regs.
And I might note, the liquid plot, as complex as it was, you were able to ultimately change security precautionary measures almost within 24 hours.
Within 4 hours.
Completely. It initially banned all water. But, the idea being you were able to then recalibrate that quickly, and that's all because of the good intelligence with sharing with your counterparts in the UK and the like.
Yeah.
Can you talk to that case or not really?
Oh, sure. Brevin? Yeah. No, you know, you were here in 2009 and left in the beginning of 2009. It's now here in the middle of 2012, and now you're showing up with a book. What took you so long? And that is a good question. And the answer is that, well, you know,
only someone who's never written a book would say it that way.
No, but it does take a little time. But what we did, and I am deeply indebted to the Director of National Intelligence and the TSA and the FBI, is that I worked with them transparently and gave them all my stuff and worked through, and we had a year's worth of debate, I would say, one by one, going through the examples I used that were at the highest compartmented level to make my case that this ought to be, at this point, made known to the public. And finally, on Thanksgiving, the day before Thanksgiving of this last year, I got that precious little email that says, your manuscript is approved by the Director of National Intelligence, and they hit the send button on it. So that's what I think will be interesting about this book, because I can pontificate about security measures. You've all probably heard me do it at great length. But connecting it to the real world of classified intelligence, I think, gives you a better feeling of what TSA is all about.
I think that would give the general public a better awareness of some of the challenges facing the community day in, day out. So it cuts both ways. We have two questions here and then here. And please identify yourself, Michael.
Hi, I'm Michael Kraft, former State Department Counterterrorism Office. And during that time, I worked somewhat with the Interagency Technical Support Working Group and realized that there were a number of generations, shall we say, of detection equipment for airports. Could you describe the decision to go ahead with the equipment that caused so much controversy over privacy? Why did TSA go ahead with that, even though newer versions that were less invasive were on the horizon? Was it going with what you had, so just in case, or the seat, cover your ass kind of provision, or what? Okay. You're the illusion. But what were the factors? Was this driven by S&T, Science and Technology, or by your office? How did that system work?
Well, when I was there, we deployed let me re-answer the question. The previous protocol was to use the body scanners only in secondary screening, which would mean that you would have to alarm the magnetometer before you would go and get looked at by the body scanner. So it does not take, I mean, I think even Richard Reed could figure out that if he went through with all the explosives he wanted and nothing metallic in his pockets, he would never, ever see a body scanner. And the only people who would ever get the body scan were people like you and me who forget our things and no. So I made a lot of very angry people. I didn't realize at the time that I was doing this, but they were very angry. I said, no, we're not going to use them in secondary. We're going to use them in primary. And that changes the equation, because one way of doing body scanning took 45 seconds a shot, and therefore you're not going to use that in primary screening. The other one took 12 seconds, and you could work with that. And it had privacy algorithms that Leslie Stahl described in Shock as, those aren't pornographic. So we really didn't have a problem with the body scanners when I was there. And now I think the other technology has picked up its speed and things have changed. So I really did not have an issue. Secretary Chertoff went through it all very carefully and supported it. So frankly, it was, even the ACLU, while they had concerns, we showed them the stuff, and it really was not a problem. So I think the subsequent use of it is, you know, I can't really comment on it. Did I answer your question?
Not quite, but...
What part didn't I...
Well, I'm trying to figure out who made the decision basically to pick that particular machine. Was it your office or TSA or the Science and Technology or both? Or?
The TSA made the decision. When I only speak about when I was there, but TSA made that. And I should say, Secretary Chertoff was intimately involved in every step of that, because he was particularly interested. So we made that decision to go with this particular technology because we want to use it.
Is it far down the road? Or?
Yes. Yes, we were concerned about the same thing the current administrator is concerned about.
We need a question up front here. Please identify.
Yeah, I'm Charlie Clark with Government Executive Magazine. Unionization question, but back when Homeland Security was set up, there was a big political fight over whether TSA out of the unionized, and more recently they have voted to have the option. So I'm just wondering your ideas of how that might impact the incentives of the workers and the ability to innovate.
Well, that's exactly the issue I have, and it does performance-based pay go out the window in favor of seniority? If that's the case, I think we are not going to get where we need to get in terms of engagement with the public. I think having the TSOs highly trained, highly engaged with performance metrics and pay based on that is an essential security agreement. I'm not sure where TSA is at this point in terms of their progression toward that, but I think it is absolutely critical that the officers, those frontline officers, feel as committed personally to the mission as the administrator, and that whatever we do, union, not union, it needs to preserve that performance basis.
So you're not saying whether they're more likely to feel committed if they're in a union?
I'm saying that if you're paid on a seniority basis, you're more concerned. Well, you are very concerned about the mission, but you also are going to follow the rules so you don't mess up that every so often you get a pay raise. And performance-based makes you realize, yeah, I got a lot at stake here, not just the mission, but my pay is based on how successful I am. So that's the critical thing. And there are many opinions about whether you should have unions or not, but I think this, the prime security issue is the motivation of the TSOs.
Any other specific question to Kip, please? And please wait for a mic to come.
Good afternoon, Mr. Hawley. My name is Greg Sharma with George Washington University, the Engineering School. And the question, you've got a very large operational frontline workforce that interfaces with the public on a daily basis. And you know, in my particular case, I probably encounter them 20 to 30 times a year. And probably in the past 10 years, maybe I've had one incident where I was upset by something. And every other time, understanding and things went smooth and as I expected in that. And it just seems like you guys get beaten up constantly by the grandmother who has to take off the pen or something, these little anecdotal types of things that occur 1 in 100 times or 1 in 1,000 times or something like that. And I just don't see TSA pushing back real strong of trying to give a more positive message of, you know, the successes rather than these isolated failures.
Yeah, it's hard to draw a large media contingent to hear about your successes, et cetera, where
Well, you've heard a little over half of the presentation of Mr. Hawley. It's kind of an interesting presentation. And again, he makes the point that some of the things he's saying doesn't get heard in the media very often. So you can go to booktv.org. And the book is called Permanent Emergency. And his name is Kip, K-I-P, Hawley, H-A-W-L-E-Y. And you can hear the rest of the show. It's very interesting. Well, that's it for tonight. We'll be signing off, and we'll have Vera Lynn sing that lovely song she sings, We'll Meet Again.
We'll meet again. Don't know when. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again, don't know where. Don't know when, but I know.